door using drones. The future of pizza delivery may involve them. And photographers, architects, planners, law enforcement, TV producers, emergency rescue teams, hobbyists, all have visions of how to use these devices. We've been waiting a while for the Federal Aviation Administration to make rules governing their use. Those rules obviously are necessary. After all, close calls with commercial jetliners have already been reported. But the FAA has been slow to act, so many states have taken matters into their own hands. Here in North Carolina, Governor McCrory has already signed legislation regulating the use of unmanned aircraft systems. There are many questions to be asked and answered about drones among them. Who owns the skies? And how do you ensure public safety if vast numbers of these things are suddenly being used commercially? So we're going to take a closer look at that this hour with Chris Gibson. He is the Unmanned Aircraft System Manager for the newly formed NCDOT Division of Aviation UAS Office. And UAS, of course, stands for Unmanned Aircraft Systems. Welcome to the program.
Thank you much, Mike.
Nice to have you here. Liz Woolery is a policy analyst with New America's Open Technology Institute. She's a former newspaper reporter, now PhD candidate in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UNC Chapel Hill, whose research has focused on the right to gather information in public places and digital free expression and privacy issues. Liz, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we're joined by Halsey Smith, the chairman and chief executive officer of Aerokinetics. His company holds the distinction of having filed the very first commercial certification request with the FAA for a multi-rotor unmanned aircraft system. I guess that's one of those whirligigs that we see in the air. Is that right, Halsey?
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Nice to have you here. All right. Most of the so-called drones that most of us have seen have been on television in news reports about our conflicts in the Middle East and how we're using these aircraft in war zones. The only drones that I've seen domestically are the toys that hobbyists buy. I think 60 Minutes did a story about a photographer at the Golden Gate Bridge, and they showed pictures from that they attached cameras to these things. Are those the only, these toy-like devices, are they the only unmanned aircraft currently legally operating in the United States?
No, Mike, they're not. There are obviously the toys that are typically meant for recreational use.
Mm-hmm.
That is governed, under a dispensation that's been made for recreational use. It's been around for 40, 50 years. In addition to those, you have ones that look similar, but maybe a little bit larger, a little more capable, things like that, that people are using for agriculture, for emergency management, infrastructure inspection, all kinds of different uses.
Does anybody know how many of these non-hobbyist drones are being used right now in the country, around the country?
So the FAA maintains a database, mm-hmm, of all the folks that have gotten what we call Section 333 exemptions for commercial operations. They also maintain a database for certificates of authorization, or COAs, for public use systems. Both of those databases are publicly available.
Mm-hmm.
You can go on the FAA's website, look for UAS, and you'll find links to both of those where you can find out who's operating.
Halsey Smith, you're in the business of building these for the aerospace and defense industry, but also for, I think, private clients. Is that correct?
The big differences that you see in the market space is the technologists, mostly from Silicon Valley and otherwise, are pushing the FAA to certify or provide those COAs or COAs, as discussed a second ago, for these hobbyists type systems to advance the commercialization in that market space. But these toys don't really have the technology included of manned aircraft or life flight helicopters, or in the case of Dallas, Texas 2 weeks ago, Virgin America, Airbus airliners. They're flying inside the flight paths of these aircraft because people don't know not to stay out of those flight paths in general. And this can be both the hobbyists who are flying them for fighters, flying outside of the limitations of their COA.
Because
they don't have technology like ADS-B in and out, they're really putting a lot of people in jeopardy, not understanding how to operate these toys.
Yeah,
our approach has been.
How high can these little toys fly? How high can they actually go up in the air? In other words, the physics of it.
The FAA that they've flown above 5,000 feet.
Above 5,000 feet. And do they not come when you buy these at a store? Do they not come with instructions not to fly above a certain height? And how would you know how high your thing is flying anyway? Did they have altimeters on them?
They do have they do have various sensors on there that let you know where you are and how high you are. And with the more professional ones, for sure, that will tell you how high you are above the ground at your current location. But again, in the end, it comes down to people actually knowing what the rules are.
Right.
And deciding to follow them, just like anything else.
So the ones that your company, AeroKinetics, is building, Halsey Smith, what are they like as opposed to these hobbyist devices?
So our systems are really designed with aerospace design and engineering behind the systems. So we put ADS-B, which is the automatic dependent surveillance system, which basically to incorporate these systems inside of the air traffic control architecture that the United States currently enjoys. The FAA has been so great at their job over the years that we have the safest and most well-protected airspace in the world. And these hobbyist systems, these toys, are not designed to interface with the FAA's architecture for aircraft. As far as aircraft control, also getting into the certification of airworthiness, which is a whole different question. And our systems are built as a true aircraft. So think of building them as a Cessna or a Boeing aircraft, the same type of our systems. It's not like we're going into the garage and building something that's a model airplane. It's a totally different aspect. I don't want to push back and say model aircraft are not something that's fun and appropriate to fly. They're just not appropriate to be integrated into the national airspace system. And that's really the challenge that we see is you're not going to be able to do that in the near future without really taking the it's been well established over the last 70 years.
So help me to understand this integration into the national airspace system. If I'm a guy who goes out and spends a couple of $100s on what you would call a toy drone, but it has the capability of going 5,000 feet in the air if I don't know the rules or if I want to break the rules and let it go that high. And if I want to fly it over an airport landing area, I can do that. I'm not supposed to do it, but if there's nobody there to stop me and I feel like doing it, I'm going to do it. How do you what are we to do with that information? I guess it's my question.
So the bottom line is if you get caught – you can be charged with a number of different crimes, both at the state level and the federal level. Particularly if you're operating around an airport or in the flight path of other aircraft, you can be charged with interfering with an aircraft.
Are these toy drones, the ones that anybody can buy, are they marked in any way? Is there a serial number that can be traced back to the person who bought the drone so that if in case it lands on the White House lawn, for instance, or it goes up and interferes with a commercial airliner, that we can say, okay, you bought it, it's yours, you're responsible?
So the FAA put in place, I guess, about a year ago, a new ruling that said anything that's going to be used commercially or for public use, meaning a governmental agency is basically owns it and uses it, has to have an N number, just like a regular aircraft. The hobby systems don't. That is what, in my personal opinion, is kind of a hole in the regulations right now, are these hobby systems. On the one hand, you don't want to take away the privilege that people have had for 40, 50 years to fly model aircraft and to enjoy that hobby. At the same time, now that's moved from something where people kind of buy and build and are really into the hobby versus somebody that spends $200 and thinks they can fly it.
How are these different from model aircraft? Because, as you say, model aircraft have been around and for the most part been used responsibly by hobbyists for 40 years, 50 years. How are they different?
I think a big part of the difference is now they're so available commercially. In that you buy it, it's already built, it's ready to go. You don't need any piloting skills to do it. So there's really, you don't have to go through kind of a serious progression of learn how to build it, learn how to actually fly stick and rudder an airplane or, stick and rotor, helicopter type thing. You can just click a few buttons and off it goes.
Yeah.
So that cultural change is the biggest piece.
Sure. Well, and also one of the biggest reasons we've seen an advancement is you used to have to be Mr. Wizard to fly a model aircraft and, you know, understand RF or radio frequency communication, understand basic principles of and be able to operate these, you know, model aircraft or helicopters. But with the advent of the smartphone and the advent of advanced battery technology and the advent of gaming haptics, I mean, I hate to say this, but we are now a culture in America where everyone has played a video game at some point in their life and generally has an understanding of how to operate one. And because of all this background technology acceptance, we're able to operate these unmanned aircraft very simply. I mean, we did a test one time with one of our engineers at one of our test sites and handed the controller of our unmanned system to a five-year-old, one of our engineer's sons, and he operated it with no problem. Was handing him the controller. So when you can have a five-year-old operate an unmanned system based on the ease of use, now the barriers to operation have been diminished. And then when you have organizations that are pushing those as toys, you know, selling them for, you know, $2,000, the acceptance of that is growing. Now, and we don't want to, you know, call out the hobbyist market or the toy market, because certainly that has been a huge driver for the emphasis on technology shift. But there has to be a level of responsibility that goes along with that, and most hobbyists have a tremendous level of responsibility and feel you know that they need to provide for their community,
right?
Just like everyone else.
Liz Woolery has been sitting very quietly in the studio in Washington, and we're going to bring her into the conversation because aside from some of the concerns we've been talking about, there are other concerns with the use of these devices, and that is that most of them, if not all of them, have cameras attached or have the ability to have cameras attached to them. Is that where you get involved in this, the fact that these can be used for surveillance purposes, either by hobbyists who are just curious and maybe peeping Toms, or by law enforcement?
It is. I've kind of taken a look at the issue from the perspective of how do we protect privacy while also encouraging use of what could be a really fantastic tool for journalists and citizen journalists and news gathering. And as Chris pointed out, these UAS are incredibly accessible in terms of cost, in terms of maintenance, in terms of operation. And that's a lot of the appeal. And so it means that we can put this incredible tool in the hands of news gatherers and journalists, but also in the hands of some folks who may not have the best intentions when it comes to respecting privacy.
Well, you use the term citizen journalist, and that's a term that's emerged a lot because many people have blogs. Anybody can have a blog. There are a lot of people on social media who are reporting things and acting like citizen watchdogs, and there's a good part to that, but there's also potential for abuse to that. Do you see citizen journalists using these devices with cameras for good or for bad?
Well, I think it really depends on the person, on the use, on the place, on the time, on the capabilities. We've seen citizen journalists who have used cell phones to great success, but also have done so in ways that are concerning, and we might do the same with UAS.
We'll continue that line of questioning in a little bit here with Liz Woolery, policy analyst for the New America's Open Technology Institute. We're taking a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Caramont Health, a leading independent healthcare system distinguished by its care. More information available at caramonthealth.org. Well, perhaps you've heard of Lewis Lang. He is the self-employed man from Fort Mill who opposed the Affordable Care Act and opted not to buy coverage. He's self-employed, only to later discover he was losing his eyesight from a pre-existing condition. So he tried to apply for Affordable Care Act, and he had missed the deadline. His story was local, but it soon went viral around the country, and it attracted help in the form of donations, but also a significant amount of derision. So Lewis Lang and his ophthalmologist will share his story and where it's headed with us tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, more than 500,000 Americans have annual prescription drug bills of at least $50,000. What's behind soaring drug costs and the push for new pricing models?
join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about unmanned aircraft systems, drones, being used by hobbyists, and eventually we'll talk about their commercial use and their potential for commercial use within the continental United States. We're talking about all this with Chris Gibson, who is UAS Program Manager for the North Carolina Department of Transportation Division of Aviation Unmanned Aircraft Systems Program Office. You guys in state government, I don't know how you put it all on the door. Halsey Smith is chairman and CEO of Aerokinetics. They're a company that builds these devices. And Liz Woolery is a policy analyst with New America's Open Technology Institute. We began talking just before the break, Liz, about some of the privacy concerns, and I want to go into some of these. But it not only has the – just as in any emerging technology, the law tends to lag behind the technology. Technology moves quicker and the law has to catch up governing their use. It seems to me that also social norms have to catch up, do they not? Because a lot of people who might buy these hobbyist devices, put a camera on them, and fly them around the neighborhood and look down and record backyard parties or whatever, are doing this thinking that there's absolutely nothing wrong with looking in on the neighbors and what they're doing, when in fact, there is, isn't there?
Right. So one of the issues that we've seen is changing expectations, changing social norms with the rise of cell phones that, you know, come equipped with audio, video, and other recording capabilities. It's almost like we've become immune to the fact that there are cameras watching our every move, both, you know, by state actors as well as private actors. So there may be some concerns there in terms of how we are now responding and reacting to constantly being monitored, watched, and recorded. One issue with UAS in particular is that they have some unique capabilities, such as the potential for persistent surveillance. You could have a UAS following you around for hours at a time, minutes at a time, days at a time, documenting your every move. They can be equipped with sensors such as license plate readers. So we're really talking about a different level of surveillance, a different level of being watched.
And when you talk about that level of surveillance, are you talking about that from a professional point of view, either private detectives or law enforcement, or are you talking about hobbyists just doing this for kicks?
I've mostly focused on the private actors. The government actors pose some different questions and issues, but hobbyists doing it for kicks, also paparazzi following celebrities, a stalker following someone. There are harmful...
I got to interrupt you. So first off, I'm familiar with all those technologies of license plate readers and those type systems, and we're not talking about something you can do with a $15,000 toy, okay?
Correct.
To be able to really be successful in a surveillance operation, you're going to spend well over $100,000, $150,000 to have something even at the baseline of technology. So it's fear-mongering, in my opinion, that the technology is really providing for, you know, the police state of America in the hands of private citizens. Our systems are not designed to provide surveillance for the public to be able to access them. Our systems are designed to be able to move defibrillators to heart attack patients faster than ambulance can get there. They're designed to be able to climb extension ladders to provide roof inspections, and they're designed to provide search and rescue efforts when manned aircraft can't get out there. So the whole, you know, Kardashian theorem, as I like to call it, right, where the paparazzi is chasing them 24/7, is really not the largest concern for unmanned aircraft in the United States, at least in our opinion.
But should it be a concern? Because where there is technology, there is room for abuse of that technology if it falls into the wrong hands or somebody's not thinking clearly.
I'd like to jump in, jump in here. Just like Halsey just said, you know, the bottom line is that all the stuff that we've been talking about today and the things that are authorized or are being allowed to be flown both by hobbyists and professional users in the U.S. on a regular basis, these are all relatively small systems. The vast majority of them have total flight times from takeoff to landing that they're capable of mm-hmm. of less than an hour. There are some that are a little bit more than an hour.
And that's because of battery life?
It's battery life and the size of the systems. The size of the systems that are allowed to fly under current regulation without a lot of special dispensation, they're small. So the bottom line is you're talking about small cameras. You're talking about short flight times. Mm-hmm. So nobody
today,
is going to use—
Today, but in 5 years, the technology will be super advanced.
It will. It will. At the same time, the other thing that I wanted to mention is all those laws against unwarranted surveillance mm-hmm. by both private and public actors, all those laws, the peeping Tom laws, all those things are still in effect regardless of whether you use a UAV, a cell phone camera, or an old Polaroid camera.
But from your point of view, Liz, we live in a society where our lives have become almost an open book because so many people are on Facebook posting everything about themselves and pictures about their family. And if you're not posting it on Facebook, somebody else is posting it about you or tweeting about you. This is just another piece of that open book puzzle, isn't it?
It is in some ways, and just kind of go back a little bit. I would say that I don't think the threat of persistent surveillance is something that we need to focus all of our energies on mm-hmm. today. I think it's a concern, something that we should consider down the road. My whole point was that new technologies present new capabilities. And as you were saying, it takes the law a long time to catch up. And so if we can, from the outset, begin to identify potential uses, potential issues, even if they are outliers, that's the best way to approach the issues. And as Chris said, there are existing laws in pretty much every state that are not tailored to U.S., but they speak to UAS, whether it's wiretapping and eavesdropping, peeping Tom laws, nuisance, trespass, a variety of existing state statutes do cover certain.
And it would also seem to me that a lot of people who buy these devices, and I want to move away from hobbyists, but the hobbyists that buy these may not have ever considered these laws because they've never had technology that would break those laws. And so when they use it in such a way that it might break a law, they're completely unaware of it unless you raise the questions ahead of time. Correct?
Well, Mike,
I think you're right.
Exactly right in one regard.
Go ahead.
She has a very valid point mm-hmm. In regards to privacy and security. Where the disconnect is with the hobbyist systems that are out there is there's no means right now of accountability to determine who's actually operating a system that does fly over your backyard and takes pictures of your barbecue party or whatnot, right? Or flies over Kim Kardashian's backyard when she's, sunbathing in the nude. At this level, there's no way to determine who's operating that unmanned aircraft, which is where the disconnect is.
So,
right?
Chris,
we've
seen drones land on the White House lawn. We've seen drones interfere with commercial airliners in their landing pattern at airports around the country. The FAA says that these small model aircraft should be flown in sufficient distance from populated areas and away from full-scale aircraft. But the first drone I ever saw fly in Charlotte, I saw flying on Christmas night in a neighborhood near South Park Mall. This thing was up in the air, and it went down and went past my windshield because I guess it had a camera attached to it. I thought it was fascinating. I didn't feel intruded upon, but I thought this could be a hazard, I suppose.
Sure.
You can't control the people who control these things. And if the FAA doesn't know what you're doing and you don't know the law, what are we supposed to do with that? What should we be doing? You're in charge of this at the NCDOT.
Yeah, so the biggest question right now is how do we deal with the recreational users? Again, we don't want to take away the privilege that people have had for decades now to fly model aircraft and enjoy that hobby. But with so many more people getting into this now, and people that haven't traditionally respected those types of rules. There's a hole there. The FAA has been reluctant to dive into that for good reason. There's a strong lobby. And as such, you know, the states have been reluctant to do that as well. Right now, our focus in the state of North Carolina is on the professional user, and both at the public agency level, as well as the commercial operator level.
Well, the FAA, it makes regulations for aviation. Why did North Carolina, and I believe 9 other states, feel it was necessary to set up their own version of the FAA and have their own laws? This Division of Aviation in the Program Office of Unmanned Aircraft Systems is a North Carolina invention. Why did we feel the need to have that?
Okay, so 10 states passed laws last year in 2014 related to UAS. At this point, that's up to 26. So the bottom line is, you know, states are all getting into the game. In North Carolina, I won't speak for other states, but for North Carolina, we are not attempting to become our own FAA. We are not attempting to regulate the airspace use at all. The bottom line is the FAA has authority over the airspace. So if you lift off the ground outside, you are in FAA-controlled airspace. So they're regulating the airspace. What we're attempting to do is make sure that people are educated about what the law is in North Carolina about the things you can and cannot do legally with UAS, including things like unwarranted surveillance, interfering with hunting, using them to scout for hunting, and a variety of things like that. Mm-hmm. And then we've established particular laws, crimes, and penalties that are associated with the use of UAS to do certain things that you shouldn't be doing. So our role at the state is to make sure that people are aware of those laws. And then
how do you do that?
So right now we're putting together for release later this year a knowledge test that basically we're going to require that anybody that's a professional user in the state of North Carolina needs to pass this knowledge test. It's a relatively simple test, but the bottom line is it's not to duplicate what the FAA is doing by any means, but rather to say, okay, here's what North Carolina law is about what you can and can't do, where you can and can't fly. And we want to make sure that you know what those laws are.
Can we compare that? I think there's still laws on the books with the Federal Communications Commission where if you're going to set up a ham radio operation, you have to take a test for a license to operate that ham radio system. Is that correct? Is that still true? So this will be comparable to that.
It's similar. If you think about a simplified version of your driver's license test, uh-huh. because the bottom line is the law in North Carolina, it's relatively limited, mm-hmm. The specific things related to UAS. The majority of the regulation is being accomplished by the FAA.
Liz, you wrote an article about this move on the part of 10 states, now 26 evidently, including North Carolina, to design their own rules for drone operation. And you quote a Washington Post blogger as saying that state legislation thus far has been misguided and suffers from overbreadth and vagueness. Do you have an opinion on that? Would North Carolina's recent legislation fall into that category if you have that opinion?
Well, I think one of the concerns is that some state laws that address UAS might be duplicative of already existing laws. So a state law on UAS use that prohibits certain types of surveillance, for example, that surveillance may already be prohibited by existing statutes, existing laws, such as the trespassing, nuisance, peeping Tom laws I mentioned earlier. So I think one concern has to do with whether there's duplicative regulation out there that just kind of mucks up the system and gets a little bit confusing. I think there is an opportunity for state regulation to address the new issues that are posed by UAS, however.
Like, for instance?
For example, as I mentioned, persistent surveillance, but I think the licensing is a really good example of where there's an opportunity for states and the FAA to make some headway and to put some ground rules in terms of who can operate a UAS, where they can operate it, whether they have to have the UAS in their line of sight. Mm-hmm. So specifically relating to licensing and operation of the UAS.
You say that North Carolina's law prohibits the use of UAS for surveillance of private property, but you say that it never defines the term surveillance. But isn't that word self-explanatory?
You would think it is, but it's not necessarily self-explanatory. I think a lot of our conversations about surveillance today actually focus on government surveillance. So when we think about surveillance by private actors, we really have to think about what exactly that means. And one of the issues that I raised is that if you are walking down the street or driving down the street with your cell phone recording video of the houses that you drive by, that's protected by the First Amendment. You're on a public roadway. You are filming things that are visible from that roadway. But if you do that from the air in a UAS, it seems like maybe under North Carolina's law, that would be a problem. But perhaps Chris can kind of clarify or speak to that.
Chris?
So, yeah, I mean, in that case, you know, since it is a flying vehicle, there are really three things that you need. You need some kind of airspace authorization from the FAA, because once you get in the air, it's their field of play. In addition to that, in North Carolina, you have to have permission from the property owner from where you're going to launch and recover. So if that's a public road, then you have to have permission from the municipality or the state, et cetera, that owns that road. So from that standpoint, we deal with that. But at the same time, there's a law in North Carolina that's been established that says if you capture a picture or publish a picture of somebody, an image, there's a fine for that that you can put for each image that you publish
of a person or of a house or
of
a building.
Person if you don't have their permission. Mm-hmm. It's a person or a piece of property. So if you have permission from the property owner, you're fine. If you don't have permission from the property owner, publishing that information will get you fined.
Well, in this day and age when I can go on Google Earth right now and look at your house,
right,
does that law have any teeth?
Well, it has teeth. Whether it'll be effective remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. The bottom line, it does have teeth. There's a $5,000 fine associated
with it. And there are laws prohibiting the commercial use of photography using these devices. If you're a farmer and you want to survey your fields with a drone, you can. But if you're a wedding photographer, or if you're a real estate broker and you want to take an overhead shot of the neighborhood that you're selling houses in, you're not supposed to be able to do that.
Well, you're not supposed
to. And people are doing it.
You're not supposed to be able to do that without the proper authorizations. There's a series of authorizations that you can get that will allow you to do it.
When we come back, I want to talk about the high-grade versions of these devices and the piloting required for these devices. Halsey Smith is chairman and CEO of Aerokinetics. He knows a lot about that because that's what his company does. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Learning Society at Queen's University of Charlotte, a group commitment to ongoing learning and bringing national speakers to the community. Details on Learning Society memberships at queens.edu. More than 500,000 Americans have annual prescription drug bills of at least $50,000. So on the Diane Rehm Show today at 10 o'clock, they'll discuss what's behind soaring drug costs and the push for new pricing models. That starts in about 20 minutes at 10. If you'd like to join our conversation about drones and their applicability and the rules and regulations that should or do govern them at the moment, you can join our conversation, charlottetalks@wfae.org, through email, or look for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The worse the news gets, the more important it is to laugh.
Every day on Morning Edition, we try to find a small story to brighten your day.
Like the one about police in New Hampshire giving out coupons for good behavior.
Or the one about a Russian bear scared away by a Justin Bieber ringtone.
That is scary. Of course, we bring you all you need to know to start your day.
Start the week with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Listen for Morning Edition from 5 until 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about drones and their use both by hobbyists and commercially in this country as they begin to proliferate. Chris Gibson is with us. He is the Unmanned Aircraft Systems Program Manager for the North Carolina Department of Transportation Division of Aviation. Liz Woolery is here as well. She's a policy analyst for the New America's Open Technology Institute, concerned with privacy issues that may arise because of the increasing use of drones. And Halsey Smith is chairman and CEO of Aerokinetics. They make high-quality versions of this for the aerospace industry and for private concerns. Now, in the military, drones are flown by pilots. The pilots may be flying over Iraq, but they're sitting in Arizona someplace running these aircraft, and they are licensed pilots. Your company says, Halsey, that you believe high-grade systems are the ideal solution for operation anywhere in the national airspace by non-certified pilots. Why? Why would aircraft design, no matter how good, replace the need for certified pilots to operate them?
Sure. So one of the biggest challenges that we face with this is there's no clear path to a training program that provides for certification for the operation of unmanned aircraft today. The FAA is doing a great job keeping up with the literal vertical technology curve that has brought about unmanned aircraft. But there's still, which is why I applaud what Chris is doing in North Carolina. And yes, there are some challenges, going back to our last segment, that the laws may not be fully fleshed out yet. But the bottom line is North Carolina is taking a proactive approach and needs to be commended to that. Because anyone who's furthering the advancement of this technology for the betterment of our society needs to be commended for their efforts. Specifically with the piloting, to revert back there, we see the opportunity to operate unmanned aircraft by using equivalent levels of safety, which is a standard practice that's been accepted by the FAA for many years. And we can train specific operators who have specific knowledge to be able to operate our system. So it's not that we're just turning people out to go fly these things without any training. It's about developing a proper program that is fully certifying these operators to operate our type systems in the national airspace system. A fairly robust training program that you would see that any pilot would go through. So, 40, 50 hours of flight time and various levels of ground school that would provide for that. But you don't need to be a certified pilot who can fly a Boeing 737 to operate an unmanned aircraft. And that's a huge misnomer in the industry.
We've talked about the FAA and air traffic control knowing where these aircraft are. When you have a commercial grade aircraft like you're talking about building and like you do build, and these aircraft start being put into operation by various companies for various tasks, whether it be rescue missions or whether it be delivering a Domino's pizza, it seems to me that you're going to have a lot of these things in the air. How do we keep track of them? How do they keep track of each other? How do we not have mid-air collisions with the debris falling on human beings and cars and houses and things like that?
that's really good. What's happening is the FAA, along with NASA and others, are in the process of implementing the next generation air traffic control system, which is a massive upgrade to the entire infrastructure for aviation in the United States. It's a huge undertaking. And yes, it's had some delays, and it's over budget by billions of dollars, but it's a great program that they're undertaking in that regard. That calls for what we call the Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast Capability, ADS-B. And that device allows to see other aircraft in real time in their cockpits or on their screens, and also for air traffic control to track those aircraft in real time because to transmit the position information of both unmanned aircraft and manned aircraft alike across an entire spectrum of operations.
But air traffic control system in this country today is so understaffed and unmanned that they can barely keep up with airline traffic. We've had reports of near misses in the air by air traffic, by airliners, because traffic and air traffic control can't keep track of it. How can we add thousands of these smaller devices to the system and expect them to be kept up with?
Well, sure. I think that's probably a little harsh, Mike, to be that rough on the air traffic controllers. They have a really hard job. I mean, if you've been in LaGuardia,
no, I know. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying, Halsey, that they're understaffed. I'm not criticizing them. I'm saying that they need help.
Sure, absolutely. I think that the approach for integrating unmanned aircraft is making sure, you know, as Chris mentioned earlier, with the COA process that provides for inside that airspace. So, for example, if we wanted to fly in the Charlotte area, we would need to maintain a certain altitude and a certain distance away from the airport, which would decrease the air traffic controller's workload. And by utilizing an ADS-B system, which is a true transponder, that will also diminish the workload of the air traffic controllers to be able to do that. It's a tough challenge. It's not going to be easy, especially as you look at the literally, you know, probably 100,000 unmanned systems that are going to be flying in the next 5 years in the United States for commercial applications. But it's definitely something that can be done, and the FAA is being very proactive in ensuring that it can be done.
Who are your customers? You don't have to name names, but what types of companies are coming to you asking you either to design a drone for their specific use or to ask you what kinds of products you have that they might just be able to put into their fleet for their particular use?
It's companies that are in the critical infrastructure sector. So you look at, you know, power lines, power generation, natural gas, oil and gas transportation, pipeline companies, ports, railroads, those type of applications where they're trying to secure the critical infrastructure that provides for, you know, the commerce in America. And when they say that, it's more of, you know, securing everything from a substation, a power transmission station, all the way through to a water supply. And that's a huge segment of our customer base. Believe it or not, the media industry is a good size of our customer base. They really are attracted to our capability to be able to operate in the urban environments, you know, above the FAA certification process that we're going through. And then tertiarily, we're seeing, you know, private individuals who want to utilize a system that is safe to operate in their environment or has the capability to do what they want to do with it for their application. So as you look at, you know, there's a bunch of ranchers in South Texas who are inundated with, you know, cartel violence, human trafficking issues, you know, border violence and border issues. And there's private individuals on the border who, you know, love our systems to be able to secure their private property rights.
Repeat the figure again that you threw out a moment ago of what the number of these vehicles that you think you'll see in the sky in the next 5 years.
So I'll give you a better number. One of our customers, 300 systems in the national airspace system in the next 3 years. One customer wants 4,300. So if you look at the overall aspects of what we see in the market, and we're one manufacturer of unmanned aircraft. We are the first to go through the certification process, and we do have a highly advanced system, but we are one manufacturer.
So we're talking about,
if you evaluate the size of the industry, hundreds of thousands. In my opinion, as a subject matter expert, I believe in the next 5 years we will have 100,000 legally inside the national airspace system.
That is unfathomable. Divide that by 50 states, North Carolina being a big state, a large state geographically, and one that has a lot of business concerns. Can we handle that kind of air traffic in North Carolina, Chris?
Sure. Again, we're talking for the most part, you know, probably 99.9% of these vehicles that we're talking about in the next few years are going to be flying at low altitudes. We're talking 400 feet and below in most cases, over very specified geographic areas. Somebody's flying a farm field. Somebody's flying around a piece of critical infrastructure for security purposes. So they're small scale in terms of geographical area. And again, with the way the rules are right now and the way we kind of expect them to be for the next couple of years, the requirement is that the operator has to have the vehicle in their physical line of sight. No binoculars or anything like that. No, they have to have it in their line of sight. So you can't fly this thing 15 miles away or 20 miles away across town to deliver a pizza.
But even hobbyist devices have these GPS coordinator things, these GPS devices on them, so they can come back home if you do lose line-of-sight communication with them. So why wouldn't that apply to the commercial vehicles?
No, it does apply. It absolutely does apply, and they will come home on their own. But when we talk about line-of-sight, visual line-of-sight, that's more of a safety measure that the FAA has put in place so you can look at your air vehicle and make sure it's not going to run into anything.
When you look up in the air now and you see an airplane, if it's low enough, you can identify almost whether it's an American Airlines plane or a U.S. Airways plane or whatever. If you look up at the sky, you can tell that it's Chopper 9 versus the police department's helicopter. When you look up in the sky at these drones, when we get hundreds of thousands of them in the air, how will we know whose drone that is or what company is operating that device in case it has an accident? How will we know who to go to?
We'll know once it's on the ground. That may not be the answer you want to hear, but you're not going to look at an airplane that has 3-foot wingspan.
And does that raise privacy concerns, Liz? I mean, if we don't know what's up there, and there are hundreds of thousands of these devices up there, and I'm assuming that they're not going to be like in Iraq and Afghanistan, we will be able to see them flying around. Does that raise privacy concerns?
Anytime you are unaware of being recorded, watched, surveilled, anything like that, you can invoke privacy concerns. But, you know, as Chris said, these aircrafts do have markings. Recently, the FAA put out a notice of proposed rulemaking, and in that notice, they do have a requirement that unmanned aircraft be marked in a particular way. They have specifications about the size and basically say you must display these markings in the largest manner possible. So in the end, it may not be until the aircraft is on the ground, but you will be able to identify it.
Because there's not much surface area on most of these drones to put big logos and things like that. You wrote an article, Liz, in which you mentioned that Domino's Pizza flew what they called a dummy copter, which successfully delivered 2 pizzas in the United Kingdom. You talked about San Francisco's taco copter, in which flying robots deliver tacos. In Wisconsin, a beer drone served ice fishermen holed up in ice shacks until that device was grounded by the FAA. Now, these people either did this illegally, or they did it not knowing that the law was there, or they did it because maybe in the UK you could deliver a pizza by a drone. I don't know. But if Wisconsin had a drone law, would it have superseded the FAA law? Who has jurisdiction here? Why are these things happening?
The federal government, anytime we have regulations from the federal government, they'll always kind of supersede ones from the state, but the state can add on or build on to those. For example, a lot of my work focuses on the First Amendment, which protects the right to free speech and free press, and states can actually provide additional or further protections for press and speech, and this is going to be the same thing with state laws governing UAS.
For the most part, commercial concerns have a lot at stake, so they're probably not going to break the law, as hobbyists might be right now because they either don't know the law or who's going to catch them. There's not enough people policing this. But last year, a group of professors expressed concern with the FAA's current restrictions because the FAA is moving slowly on this, and commercial drones have more restrictions. And they say it is concerning that a 10-year-old hobbyist can freely fly model aircraft for recreation while our nation's scientists, engineers, and entrepreneurs are prohibited from using the technology in the same types of environments. Why? I'm sure, Halsey, you're on their side. So why has it taken the FAA so long to figure this out?
Well, part of it, it's the vertical technology curve as you evaluate this. I mean, as we've really pushed, there's a reason why that we're seeing the FAA enforcing a taco delivery aircraft, a beer drone, and a pizza delivery aircraft. It's because the technology is really being pushed by the youngest generation out there. Moving that technology curve forward, they're doing things with them that are interesting to them. And so, it's kind of un-American to shut down the beer drone, if you ask me. I mean, I'm fully supportive of the FAA, but at some level, this is how technology comes about. I mean, look at the computer industry, you know. Bill Gates, Michael Dell are building computers in garages. It's the same system here with unmanned aircraft. So we're pushing that with the FAA very hard. The FAA gets a bad rap with the unmanned aircraft integration efforts. But from my experience, and I've been D.C. and I've been in L.A. and I've been everywhere meeting. We've met with 14 different FAA offices, and they could not be more supportive of what we're doing inside the national airspace system. I think what you're seeing in the industry is a lot of this drumbeat, tech startup billionaires who want to integrate toys into the National Airspace System to drive margin. We think that's the most dangerous part.
Very quickly, let me bring up some questions being asked by listeners. Peter in Wesley Chapel says, can you quickly address noise pollution? Because if there are going to be 100,000 of these things in the air, what's that going to be like?
So our systems, I can't speak for everybody, but our systems have an 85 dB rating at 10 feet away at 6 foot off the ground at takeoff and operating at about 60 feet. They're about the same noise signatures you have from an air conditioning vent, just like in my office here, or otherwise. So noise pollution for us is not a huge concern. Maybe for larger, you know, systems in the future, you know, in 2025 when we're starting to see, you know, unmanned ambulance helicopters. But right now we don't see noise as a huge issue for these small unmanned aircraft.
And since there is such a concern about terrorism, Michael wants to know, since drones can carry packages, what's to prevent a terrorist or a terrorist sympathizer from carrying a bomb or dropping it over a populated area on a drone very quickly, very quickly?
So that's a very good question. We have the same exact issue with somebody but flying a model airplane for recreational today or 30 years ago. It's the same problem. We still have to work a solution.
That's Chris Gibson, UAS Program Manager for the NCDOT Division of Aviation. Liz Woolery joined us from Washington, a policy analyst for New America's Open Technology Institute, dealing with privacy issues. And Halsey Smith is Chairman and CEO of Aerokinetics, building the next drone hovering over your neighborhood. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our associate producer is Alexia Girodi, and the engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru.